Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After today's comments, we will open the call for questions and answers. At that time, you may press star, then one on your phone's keypad in order to ask a question in conference. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections to this, please disconnect at this time. And now I'd like to turn the call over to your host, Ms. Congresswoman Kathy McMorris-Rogers and Congressman John Shadegg. You may begin.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this afternoon. I'm Kathy McMorris-Rogers from Washington State, and I'm pleased to introduce with me on the call John Shadegg, who is Congressman out of Arizona. He's on the Energy and Commerce Committee and has been talking about healthcare solutions from a Republican perspective for many, many years, and has was very active in the debate on health savings accounts, on association health plans, and I'm really pleased that he's here to help give you the inside scoop as to where we are with healthcare reform. Just so you know, we've been talking healthcare reform for many weeks with these bloggers, but I think what's going to be especially valuable is for you to be able to share just some of the things that maybe they don't hear on the nightly talk shows. As everyone is aware, the Senate Finance Committee has passed the Baucus bill. They're now going to be working out the differences. In the House, I think the big question is how they're going to pull this together, because when you look at the numbers and the fact that you have to get 218 votes in the House to move a bill forward, you have 44 Democrats who have said that they oppose the public option, which means that they wouldn't have 218, and then you have 57 Democrats who have said that they'll vote no on any bill without a strong public option. So they definitely have some challenges ahead in the House as far as how they move forward. But I think Congressman Shadegg might be able to help shed some light on where we are.
Thank you, Kathy, for letting me participate in this. And I enjoy the opportunity to talk with bloggers who are interested in healthcare reform. I guess there are lots of things happening that we could talk about. Last week, there were all kinds of issues that I'm sure you all blogged about. One of the ones that I found fascinating was that the Democrats were high-fiving each other over the CBO score of the Baucus bill having come in at only $829 billion. But as I'm sure many of you know, that score is subject to very serious criticism. My favorite criticism of it is that because the Baucus bill begins taxing Americans in 2010 but doesn't start paying any healthcare benefits until 2013, the score which CBO gave it was based on 10 years of revenue from the taxes but only 7 years of expenditures. I went home this weekend and said to my wife, Shirley, heck, even our family budget would look good if we could count 10 years of our salaries but only 7 years of our expenditures. Only in Washington could that kind of score be taken seriously. But quite frankly, there were other scandals that emerged around the Baucus bill last week. I hope they've all come to your attention. I'll just mention them in case you want to ask questions. One was the whole Harry Reid scandal. You know he's in trouble in Nevada. He's down in the polls to his Republican opponents, even though there's an open primary as to who will be his opponent. So he figures out a way to get the bill amended to have the federal government pick up both halves of the increased cost in Medicaid for 4 states, one of which is Nevada. Medicaid is typically funded by some money from the federal government and some money from the states. Senator Reid, wanting to look good to get reelected, said, well, you know, in my state, and then to make it look a little bit better, he included 3 other states, we'll just let the federal government pick up both halves. That means that those of us that live in any one of the other 46 states are going to be subsidizing this bill and its additional Medicaid provisions in those 4 states. I think they are Nevada, Oregon, Michigan, and one other I can't recall. But, you know, you and I all get to subsidize it because a powerful senator was able to sneak that language in. That, I think, kind of is the introductory comment to what I call healthcare Soviet gulag style. And what I'm telling at least my constituents is, under this bill, you're going to get Soviet-style healthcare, under which the quality of care you get and the amount you pay for it may depend less on your merits or the doctor you go see and more upon whether or not you happen to live in a state with a powerful senator. The Reid story illustrates that, but then again, there are others. As you know, Chuck Schumer got into the bill kind of a sneaky little provision that protects New Yorkers. In this one, Mr. Baucus believes that they should finance the Senate bill by imposing a tax on so-called gold-plated health care plans. And so the bill has a taxing mechanism that says if you have a health care plan that costs more than $21,000, then you're going to pay a 40% luxury tax on the cost of that plan over $21,000. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York decided, no. Healthcare in New York is more expensive, and besides which, I need to keep my constituents happy. So he lobbied a provision into place that says the tax on gold-plated healthcare plans in some states, and I believe there are 17 of them, doesn't go in or into effect until the policy gets to a higher dollar level. I believe in New York, it's $24,000. I think in Massachusetts, it's $25,000. And you'll probably all be shocked to know that most of those 17 states happen to be blue states with powerful Democrats, a fair number of them, I'm guessing, with powerful Democrats up for re-election. Not to be outdone, Senator Debbie Stabenow and Senator John Kerry decided that, you know, union health care plans are sometimes quite generous, so they got a $5 billion provision into the bill to help underwrite the cost of health care for union members. Pretty good deal if you can get it. Not to be outdone, Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, who has many drug manufacturers, he's kind of a piker. He only got into the bill $1 billion as a tax credit for R&D work on pharmaceuticals. So there you have it. You have healthcare politics style. And this is all just in the negotiations to get the bill out of committee. Now, there was a kind of a harbinger of where we're going with the bill once it gets to the floor, because confronted with the news that Senator Harry Reid had gotten his state its burden of Medicare taxes picked up by the federal government, so the state didn't have to pay its share, somebody confronted Senator Mark Udall of Colorado, and they said to him, well, Senator, if the people of Utah don't have to pay their share of the Medicaid expenditures, don't you think you should be doing something for Colorado? To which Senator Udall responded, well, as a matter of fact, I do, and rest assured that when the bill goes to the floor, I'll be insisting that the people of Colorado get the same kind of financial break that the people of Utah got. So before the end of the day, you're going to see full-on Soviet-style gulag healthcare where what your healthcare looks like and what you get depends upon whether or not you're lucky enough to be represented in the United States Congress by someone who is in the party of the president or the majority party in Congress or maybe a committee chairman in the House or a powerful senator like Harry Reid or Chuck Schumer. I think Kathy says you've been talking about this issue for weeks. The only thing I would say to you is this bill will pass. And it will pass in a form as bad as the version of H.R. 3200 that America rejected in August, unless, and you're the unless the American people rise up as passionately again as they did in August this month and next month and say no. Because quite frankly, here in Washington, Mrs. Pelosi has delayed the vote. She has used the mainstream media to convince most Americans that those who demonstrated in August were just right-wing nuts, that mainstream America actually likes this bill, and she's got her moderates threatened within an inch of their lives. There are interesting stories about threats that have been made to Democrat members to try to get them on board on this bill. And again, our only hope of stopping this legislation, which I think will lead to a flood of left-leaning legislation, cap and trade, card check, you name it, is for the American people to rise up like they did in August. that means that's where you all come in. You are the mechanism that can educate them and teach them that they're getting a raw deal out of this, under which they're going to lose control of their health care. Their costs are going to go up. That's probably the most significant development on the Senate side. All of the studies now show, and everybody pretty much admits, that this legislation will result in health care costing more, not less. And if the American people become fed up with it and get in the faces of their members of Congress or their senator, we got a chance of stopping it. If they don't, look out. Here we go.
That was great. Healthcare politics style. That was great. Well, we'll open up for questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one. You will be prompted to record your name. You may also withdraw a question by pressing star then two. Once again, if you have a question, please press star then one. One moment for our first questions, please. Our first question is from Clyde Middleton. Your line is open.
Good afternoon, folks. Thanks for making this time. My blog is patriotroom.com, and I spent some time within 3200, specifically on the public option. And the data collection aspect is what's raising my antenna. Briefly, the senator shall collect such data as may be required to establish premiums and payment rates, blah, 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 to improve quality and to reduce racial, ethnic, and other disparities. Do I understand this, that my adjusted gross income is somehow going to be accessed by HHS from the IRS, is going to be cross-tabbed with my race and my other immutable attributes to determine what premium that I'm going to pay?
I'll yield here.
I didn't. This is Congressman John Shadegg. I did not bring my copy of H.R. 3200, but there is language in H.R. 3200. I cannot, by memory, recall the page number. I wish I'd brought the bill with me, which talks about real-time access to data that would qualify people for the subsidies in the bill. And based on that language, many people believe access to personal information will, in fact, be available and are very concerned about that kind of public policy. I'd have to read the language to you and let you reach your own conclusion. I believe those of us that are concerned about this language in the bill and many other provisions in the bill where the language is loose and encourages interpretation, the authors of the bill, and trust me, it was written solely by Democrats, at least the House bill, H.R. 3200 was, have a duty to write it with a sufficient clarity so that these kind of issues don't come up. I can't definitively say whether your personal information would be accessible and to whom it would go. I can tell you that there is language in the bill, and if you'll call my office and speak with either myself or my healthcare LA, who is also my alleged director, Paul Edetel, we can cite that language in the bill to you. You can read it and reach your own conclusion.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Our next question is from Michael Proto. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm from Red County Blog and also Conservatives with Attitude Blog. My question pertains to a story that came out last week, and I did a blog post on it, in which Harry Reid would take a bill from the Senate, once it passed, and tie it to a House bill that had nothing to do with health care, and then send it to the president. Is there any basis to this at this point?
There is some rumors flying around Washington, D.C., flying around Congress, that there's the possibility that Harry Reid would try to pull that kind of a move in the Senate. I can tell you that this place would grind to a halt. I mean, the outrage by Republicans in both the House and the Senate that this would be the maneuver to get health care passed would, I think, have long-term impacts on this place.
Right, I think that was part of my follow-up. What could be done in the House if he did try to do that? Is there anything at all that could be done?
Well, we can certainly make the majority's life difficult in the House in procedural motions and just slowing it down, grinding this place to a halt, and that's part of what we can do in the House. In the Senate, You know, Senator Kyle has been over here a couple of times this week talking with House members. I mean, they're hopeful that they can even stop cloture on this bill, and they're working very hard to secure the Republicans and then look where they have some support among Democrats.
Thank you.
I think one of the issues, this is John Chaddick, one of the issues that I think has led to that that thesis or that theory is the question of whether or not this is a tax bill and therefore must be initiated in the House, in which case the ploy that you just described would be a mechanism by which the Senate could say, well, it was a House-initiated bill, albeit when it passed the House it had nothing to do with taxes, but it was a House bill. They then put this onto it and sent it back. Then they can say, well, it was a House-initiated bill. The second point I would make is that, well, we can scream a lot. Our procedural rights, should Mrs. Pelosi decide to ram this thing through, are stunningly limited. She has shut down our ability to have an impact on the process in ways which I think are just shocking. I heard, for example, today that if it comes up as a House bill, and not only might they not allow any, not a single amendment to the bill when it gets to the floor, but that they might not allow a Republican motion to recommit on the theory that it is a tax bill and motions to recommit are never allowed on tax bills in the House. So I don't know whether what you described will occur. I do know that if we had great procedural tools here, we wouldn't be looking so desperately to you for your help. But we are looking desperately to you for your help because we need you to help us get the votes to stop it straight up.
Okay. Thank you again.
Our next question is from Michael Swartz. Your line is open.
Thank you. Congressman, the Senate, I know the Senate had a vote on the Senate version of the bill, and one Republican decided to sort of switch sides and vote with the other party. Is there going to be any mechanism in the House to kind of whip the members into shooting? Is there any way and punish them later when they want to run for re-election or something like that? I'm a rank-and-file member of the party. I'm on my central committee in my county. And it's really frustrating when the conservative party line followed, and you get the turncoats like Olympia Snow. So is there any way that we can, or you can, work to keep people in line against this bill?
Well, I can tell you I don't know of any Republican in the House right now that is supporting the health care reform bill. And I would remind you that in the House, every single Republican voted against the stimulus bill, voted against the budget that has been brought forward, every single Republican. And we did that at a time when it wasn't necessarily popular. Early on, when President Obama brought forward the stimulus package, he was riding high. His approval rating was at a record level, and we stood unified against that, not because it was the popular stand, but because of a principled stand that it was the wrong approach, it was too much money, and the same thing with the budget, that they are spending way too much. And I think that you can be proud that of the Republican unified support in that in opposition to both of those bills. On health care, so far, and I don't know of any Republican, there has not been any Republican in the House vote for the bill in any of the three committees, and in fact, in each of the committees, there's been Democrats vote joining the Republicans. So there's been bipartisan opposition to this House bill in each of the three committees: Energy and Commerce, Ways and Means, and Education and Labor.
I'll tell you, it's an issue that needs to be brought up at the level of the national Republicans, though, because you get. We don't want any Republicans to be blamed for this debacle when it comes about. That's for sure.
I understand what you're saying.
Thanks, guys.
Our next question is from Andrew Ian Dodge. Your line is open.
Hello, good afternoon. This is Andrew Ian Dodge of AndrewIanDodge.com. and I have the pleasure of living in Maine in the autumn, but the unfortunate curse of being represented by Olympia Snow. Further on the question earlier, are you worried that any members of the House are going to fall into the trap, which Snow has fallen into, and possibly even Collins, where they're getting attention from Obama and all this press attention, and they think it might help them at home because they're getting praised by all the press that occasionally would ignore them? And basically, I'm worried that egos are going to kick in. And again, I ask, is there anything in the House that the members of the House can do to pressure senators of their own party to knock it off and to stick with the party line?
You know, even on, I'm thinking of the cap and trade vote that took place in the House. And there were 8 Republicans that actually voted to pass that bill. And the backlash, the feedback when they went home was so intense that I think to a person they regret taking that vote. Now I don't know if they would say that publicly, but I believe many of them actually went over to the Senate and shared with some of the Senate Republicans just the reality of what was happening on the ground and just the massive rejection of that bill. And I tend to think that was a wake-up call or that was a defining moment for a lot of Republicans in the House and really highlighted how the momentum was not with the Democrats and the agenda that they are trying to push through this Congress right now. That the momentum is in a different direction. And so that encourages Republicans to stand firm.
All right, this is Congressman John Shedig. I just want to reiterate, I think Congresswoman McMorris-Rodgers has that exactly right. Success breeds success. Defeat breeds defeat. When we all did the vote earlier this year where we were absolutely unanimous on the stimulus bill, it had members here all kind of high-fiving each other and very excited. There really isn't much that the conference can do to punish an errant member who has their own election certificate and their own voting card and is entitled to represent their constituents as they see fit. What we can do is create an atmosphere in which they recognize, and I think the comment about you're worried about egos getting involved, I think if we recognize that those egos are going to stick their finger in the air and want to know which way the wind is blowing, if they understand that it is a very dangerous vote to vote against the party on this issue, and they understand that the public is engaged and average Americans, like the Americans who turned out in August, are passionately opposed to losing the health care that they and their families rely on now. And I think that this is a big issue. We should be scaring people because the bill should scare them. This bill will destroy the health care that you have and you rely on now. Anybody who doesn't know by now that the claim that if you have a policy you like, you can keep it is abjectly false needs to open the bill and read a few pages. The bill says point blank, within 5 years, every single policy in America must meet all the requirements in the 1,026 pages, which by now, by the way, are probably 1,500 pages, or it doesn't qualify, and many of the requirements that would be imposed upon a plan will be written by a board that hasn't been created yet. I think what the House can do to impact the Senate, because that was a part of your question, is I would love to see Nancy Pelosi try to bring this bill to the floor for a vote in the House before a vote in the Senate and either have to pull it because she doesn't have the votes or actually have it go down on the floor. She's made that mistake once before. Congresswoman Rogers mentioned to you these Drudge Report numbers. 44 members say they don't want a bill with a public plan in it. And then 57 members say they won't vote for a bill that does have a public plan in it. Trust me, having been in Congress for a number of years, you never know how somebody is going to actually vote until you call the vote. When we were in the majority, I watched Tom DeLay, as whip, call vote after vote after vote when we didn't know the day the vote was being called that we actually had the votes to prevail. But at some point, you know, members will fudge and they'll shift back and forth, right foot, left foot. When you actually put the bill out on the floor, that's when you get a decision. And that is the moment in time. I think there's some chance that Pelosi will put the bill out on the floor, not knowing whether she has the votes. And if the American people rise up at that moment and say, don't you dare vote for it, and it were to go down in the House, I think that would send a huge signal. As a matter of fact, I use the phrase, the United States Senate looks at the House like we're the canary that goes down the coal tunnel. Any bill that dies in the House won't even be taken up in the Senate, because they look at us and say, well, if the House can't pass it, we don't even want to get close. They look at us like the canary in the coal tunnel. So I have used as a strategy in the past, quite frankly, on immigration legislation, kill a bill here first and the Senate will back away from it. I think if we could kill this bill here, the senators would run like scared mice away from any vote on the bill. So that's what my personal hope is, how we can influence the Senate.
Our next question is from Gary Gross. Your line is open.
Thanks for the conference call. And I just wrote a letter to the editor today in which I outlined three things that I'd like your opinion on. One is we should I highlighted the fact that this is a bill that is so full of taxes that everybody's going to get hit. Two, that because of those tax increases, there is no way that health care spending is going to decrease. And three, the unfunded mandate with Medicaid is going to hit every state in the union and make it, that's going to cause the states to raise taxes. What's your opinion on those three points?
Well, I think you said it well. The Senate bill, the Baucus bill, is spending $829 billion. And like you said, it's expanding the Medicaid, which is going to be a huge cost to the state. So they're spending $829 billion to save what they say is $81 billion. And how do they do that? They're imposing taxes on businesses and individuals all across this country. And it's estimated that that would be $500 billion worth of taxes. The other way that they come up with these totals is that they cut Medicare by $400 billion. And the Medicare cuts are, I think they're going to be shocking to a lot of people. You're talking about cutting Medicare Advantage, cutting $32 billion in cuts to skilled nursing facilities, $49 billion in cuts for home health care. The Medicare Advantage cuts are $172 billion, $4 billion in imaging services. It's a long list of cuts to Medicare. And when people start seeing how they actually come up with their how they make this balance, 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4, really, in what they're introducing.
The theory that I have, and I'd like your opinion on this too, is that once we get past just making it a numbers thing, where we actually make it personal to the families and businesses, that's the tipping point that where we can get people riled up and rallying to our side of the thing.
Well, you're absolutely right. The numbers are actually boggling, and it's really hard to get our arms around it. And we do have to make it personal. and seniors that are on Medicare, they're gonna start understanding personally how these cuts impact them. Small businesses, individuals that already have been responsible and have health insurance in this country, and now that are going to be taxed because they, you know, of the plans that they have, that's only going. I believe that people are going to be outraged.
Let me make just a couple of real quick comments. Number one, I think the three points you made are absolutely right on. Number two, to the extent that they say that this will result in a long-term reduction in the deficit, it is because under the wording of the Baucus bill, the taxes just keep going up and up and up. And so what they're really doing is they're bragging about how much they're raising taxes, a point you apparently made in your letter to the editor. Number three, if those of you who are not intimately familiar with this bill are looking for a good summary of all the additional taxes plus the additional increases in cost other than taxes that will be imposed on American healthcare consumers, Sally Pipes had an excellent piece, which I think I posted on my website. I know I sent it out to my so-called insiders in last Friday's New York Post that goes through the Baucus bill and details every single place where it will cost Americans more. And the point in your letter to the editor that says health care expenses imposed on the average American aren't going down as a result of this bill, as the president promised, they're going up, is documented very well in Sally Pipes' piece. And then the last thing I'd say is, as Congresswoman McMorris Rodgers just said, and as you said, it's really for the average American, and I think here in many ways for American women who manage households, this isn't about money. This is about their family's health care, and that's what they ought to be scared of. They're going to lose their access to the doctor they have now, to the labs they have now, to the facilities and physicians that they've come to know and trust and rely on. All that is going out the window under this bill, and it is an unnecessary change. A number of people have said to me, look, why to fix some of the problems? And there are problems with pre-existing conditions and perhaps with universal access. Why to fix those two problems? We would throw the baby out with the bathwater. Makes no sense. I had a gentleman at a speech I gave in Los Angeles on healthcare come up to me and say, you know, I own several commercial buildings. If the plumbing's leaky, I don't bulldoze the building. I fix the plumbing.
That's good. That's great. Well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there. I really appreciate Congressman Shattuck joining me today. His insights were especially helpful, and I think you probably enjoyed hearing from him. And I would encourage you to join us next week when we'll probably be continuing to talk about health care. Thank you very much.
This does conclude today's conference call. At this time, all parties may disconnect.